Welcome to another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. Marcus Papp joined, as always, by Reggie Rizzou. Coming up on today's episode, Europe's focus on clean energy appears to be paying off, and Weird Wednesday focuses on animals. Plus, on this day in history, the banana comes to England. More details on the way on Cool Stuff. Well, starting the show with some good news from Reuters, who reports a record 60% of Europe's electricity was powered by clean energy sources in January and February of this year. The surge was driven by strong year-over-year growth in hydro, solar, and wind generation, plus a rebound in nuclear power production. Now, per energy think tank Ember, total clean electricity generation was up 12% from the same time last year, with a record 516.5 terawatt hours in January and February. And if you're wondering, a terawatt is a unit of energy equal to outputting 1 trillion watts of power for 1 hour. Meanwhile, fossil fuel-powered electricity production was down to 351 terawatt hours this year. That's the lowest for the first 2 months of the year since at least 2015 and represents an 8% decrease from those same months last year. Of course, nuclear energy can be a bit controversial still, but nuclear facilities remain the largest single source of clean power in Europe, although the 172.5 terawatt hours still represent the second lowest total for the opening 2 months of the year since 2015, following the closure of Germany's nuclear power plants last year and ongoing output issues in France. Hydro dams were the second largest source of Europe's clean power, producing a record 17.6% of Europe's total electricity generation. That's up nearly 23% from last year, while wind farms were up 14% in overall generation. Solar-powered electricity generation also up 19%. Now, if Europe's electricity generation from solar and wind farms continues to expand at the pace seen in recent years, combined solar and wind output could soon overtake nuclear plants as the main source of clean power in the continent. Again, that per Reuters. Combined solar and wind generation has expanded by an annual average pace of 11% per year since 2019, while nuclear output has contracted or shrunk by around 3% a year over that same period. So far in 2024, the nearly 162 terawatt hours of electricity generated by wind and solar farms was close to 15% more than during Jan and Feb of 23 and was just 7% less than total nuclear generation this year. Now, that suggests that if combined solar and wind output expands by the same degree in early 2025 and nuclear generation also expands by the same amount as was seen this year, then total solar plus wind electricity output could surpass nuclear generation as soon as next year. Of course, a development like that would help drive total clean electricity generation to new highs, may help utilities make further cuts to fossil fuel-powered output, and accelerate regional energy transition and pollution reduction efforts. It's also worth noting that several countries, like Ireland and Portugal, are recording single days or multi-day stretches in which a two-thirds majority or greater of their populations are using renewable energy entirely. That per GNN, the Good News Network. Additionally, European countries are conceiving of ambitious new ways for integrating more green energy sources into their communities, perhaps epitomized by Liverpool's steadily progressing plan to build the world's largest tidal-powered project across the Mersey River Delta. To date, little is known about that project, but Electric reports a large dam would be built to create a barrier between the Irish Sea and a tidal basin. Large turbines would be situated beneath said dam with sluice gates, that's a type of lock, opening as the tide comes in, pulling water into the turbines to generate energy. Government-owned utility provider Mersey Tidal Power believes they can power 1 million homes and protect the city of Liverpool from floodwaters at the same time, all without disturbing the local ecosystem too much.
Okay, while this is all good news, all I can think about, I've been trying to do the math in my head this entire time, when you're talking about all that terawatts of energy, how many time machines could it supply energy for? Is that 1.21 gigawatts?
No, it's a gigawatt, at least in the Back to the Future universe it is. You know what? If you couldn't do the math on that while listening, I am not going to be able to do it right now, but good call. We could probably go back in time or afford to send quite a few people back at that rate.
That's good.
No plutonium needed.
Heading off to Weird Wednesday, this week we're going to be focusing on animals. A truck carrying 102,000 salmon recently crashed and overturned in Oregon, and all of the salmon, which were intended to replenish the salmon populations in the Imnaha River, fell out of the truck. However, by luck, 77,000 of the fish landed in a nearby creek and are expected to live. According to the press release, quote, the accident occurred on a sharp corner with the 53-foot truck rolling onto the passenger side, skidding on its side on the pavement, and then going over a rocky embankment, causing it to roll on its roof. The creek where they landed was the Looking Glass Creek, which is a tributary of the Grande Ronde River, which, by the way, I think is just fun to say. And the salmon are expected to return to spawn in future years to come. Now, it's not all good news, as 25,529 of the salmon died, and they expect around 500 to 900 fewer adult fish to return in 2026 and 2027. Seth White, a professor in the Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Sciences at Oregon State University and director of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, told CNN, quote, the Imnaha River Spring Chinook salmon populations depends on hatcheries to sustain their numbers, end quote. He did say salmon are resilient creatures, which may be why they survived the crash. Quote, in many ways, salmon are very resilient, and that's why they survived millennia in a geologically active part of the world. Many of the salmon that got spilled into the creek will likely survive because they're adaptable, within limits, and can learn new environments quickly, end quote. Also, in case you were wondering, the driver did only receive a few minor injuries. So all in all, a good news story, but to me, it's weird because what are the odds that 3/4 of the fish land somewhere where they can live?
Yeah, no doubt. That seems pretty unlikely. Unfortunately, those salmon aren't going to make their way to the river that they were intended to be in. But nonetheless, it feels like about as happy as an ending as you could have hoped for, given the circumstances of this situation.
Yeah, I'm assuming they're going to obviously try to repopulate in years to come. But for a while there, that Imnaha River is going to, I guess, suffer for their salmon populations. However, there's a new river that might have a decent salmon populations now.
Yeah, now go fishing at the Grande Ronde River.
Yep. Like I said, more fun to say. Moving on, as we all know, mountain goats can sometimes have issues with bridges, especially if trolls are involved. Sorry, a little fairy tale humor there. There was a missing mountain goat in Kansas City that got stuck under a Kansas City bridge that was just rescued. The owners of the goat believe it was stolen from their farm a few months ago. The missing goat, Chug, was believed to be hopping around on pillars that support the bridge high above the ground. I guess that's because that's what mountain goats do. I don't know. Hoping to guide it to safety, a driver who saw the goat managed to get a rope around the goat's neck. That actually only seemed to add to the danger. When firefighters tried to rappel down the side of the bridge to capture the goat, he got spooked, tried to jump to the next platform, but his hooves slipped and the rope caught, causing the goat to hang from his neck and not moving. Firefighters managed to undo the snag in the rope, creating slack in the line. The goat then fell as much as 15 feet to the ground, landing in a spot where crews had added padding in an attempt to soften the impact. They then sedated the goat, carried him in a sling to the top of a hill where they gave him oxygen. That perked the goat up. He was taken in for x-rays. According to Tori Fugate of the Kansas City Pet Project, quote, he miraculously has no broken bones, end quote. The goat had been clambering along bridge supports that are as high as 80 feet in the ground. A fall like that would have killed the goat. Fugate said this is just the latest part of the goat's adventure. He entered into the shelter as a stray on March 13th, was dubbed Jeffrey, and was adopted later that month. But he immediately jumped the fence at his new home. According to Fugate, quote, thanks to his media fame, we had somebody reach out and they said that he is very similar to their goat that went missing back in February, end quote. The family lives 2 hours away and plans to come to the shelter to confirm he is their stolen goat named Chug. If he is, they plan to bring him home with them, and the goat's adoptive owners say they're okay with that. Fugate added that, quote, he seems to be very particular about his living situation, end quote. I guess, like I said, it's what goats do. They want to be somewhere high and they want to jump around. I guess a bridge is a great place for that. although he's missing his two brothers, I don't know if this is the small goat or the little goat, the older brother goat or the oldest brother goat. I mean, you got to trick the troll somehow, right? No.
Geez, Reggie, you know, I really had to bite my tongue at the front end of that story. Fairy tale humor. You're using the term humor very loosely here.
Oh, come on. You got the three goats, Gruff, trying to cross the bridge. He's trying to cross a bridge. It works.
Retelling the fairy tale is not going to help you here.
Well, it started out with the small goats telling the troll.
And as far as I could tell, you never referenced a troll in this actual story.
We never saw the troll. We don't know it wasn't there.
All I can say is hopefully all's well that ends well for Chug, because it sounds like he's had quite an adventure, and I would have to guess he's ready to just go home and be done with it all.
And actually, I didn't know people kept mountain goats as pets. I thought mountain goats were just kind of free to roam in the mountains. I know there's people keep goats, but not mountain goats.
Yeah, that's a little bit surprising to me too, especially in Kansas City. You know, maybe if you had said somewhere outside of Denver, but to your point, even no matter where you're at, it does seem a little bit strange. I didn't realize that was a thing either.
Heading away from mammals and going to insects, as you may know, trillions of cicadas will be emerging this spring and summer to mate after their 13-year and 17-year cycles. Marcus covered this story a while ago about how two broods will be emerging at once. What you may not be aware of is cicada urine and how they pee. Instead of urinating using droplets like most insects, cicadas instead release their waste in jets like humans and other mammals. Lead author of the study on the cicada urination process, Elio Chaita, a bio-inspired roboticist.
I got to jump in here. I mean, how do you become the lead author for the study on cicada urination?
I actually get to that. It actually came about by accident.
Okay, good. I'm looking forward to that because I can't imagine any little kid out there is going, one day I'm going to grow up and talk about this particular insect's urination process. Well,
and the fact that he's a bio-inspired roboticist at Harvard University. How does that lead to cicada urine? So,
great question.
I'll get to
that. Continue, Reg.
Elio Chaita said, quote, excretion in general is not very well understood. Cicadas are some of the smallest insects, to the best of our knowledge, that can form such jets at this small scale, end quote. One aspect that makes this unique is that larger animals like humans and elephants use inertia and gravity to pull down the fluids from their bladder, which then leads to a stream or jet of urine. In fact, the study pointed out that for mammals that are more than 6 or 7 pounds, it can take on average 21 seconds to empty their bladder, in case you wanted to know that information. However, for most insects, Chaita said the process is more about surface tension and friction. Quote, surface tension is an invisible kind of force that is very significant for small insects. Just pushing a fluid at a small scale is challenging, end quote. So most small insects and mammals like bats urinate in droplets. So getting to your question, how did Chaita come to this conclusion? He experienced it. Normally, it can be hard to observe cicadas when they are high up, but after working on a different project in the Peruvian Amazon, his team was wrapping up their project and stopped for lunch when one of his colleagues felt something odd. Quote, so we went walking around, and one of our colleagues, he felt this little sprinkle on his head. And then we looked up, and we saw a lot of cicadas, end quote. So they saw 20 or 30 cicadas in the trees, eating and peeing freely. They decided to take advantage of the situation and started recording and watching the insects, you know, do their business.
How much liquid can one cicada actually have inside it, though? These aren't massive creatures. We're talking about insects.
Cicadas feed on low nutrient sap that is made up of 95% water. To get enough nutrients, they have to consume 300 times their body weight, which means they have to pee a lot. So the streams actually kind of make more sense. In fact, they take advantage of this process as they use their waste also to wet the soil and shape it around them when it comes time to create their subterranean chamber. So excreting a lot at a time kind of makes sense for several reasons. I am going to leave you with this one quote, though, from Chaita. Quote, I think people should understand science doesn't always have to be serious. It can be fun, too, end quote. I don't know if getting peed on is fun, personally, but...
Yeah, I'm not really sure how to characterize this one, but... It does call for a few laughs. That's all I can say. Never thought we'd be discussing bug urination, but here we are.
Yeah, well, you know, I never actually even thought about bug urinating. Well, besides the fact that sometimes you hold something small and you're like, what is that liquid on my hand? But, oh, by the way, I didn't mention this, but cicadas can also sometimes use that stream as a defense mechanism. So it's got a lot of purposes.
Sure. As Reggie's been known to do from time to time, too, yeah. When he feels threatened.
Yep, that's what I do. It's a good move. It's a good move. You're not going to mess with me, are you?
Get away from me. Okay, I will. Don't do that.
Taking a look at this day in history, on April 10th, 1633, the first bananas went on sale in London, marking a significant moment in the city's history and the introduction of a fruit that would later become commonplace in British diets. The bananas were reportedly displayed in the shop window of Thomas Johnson's apothecary, attracting curious onlookers and sparking interest in this exotic tropical fruit. So at the time, bananas were still relatively rare in Europe and considered a luxury item. They were brought to London from distant tropical regions, likely from the Caribbean or West Africa, where bananas had been cultivated for centuries. Now, most reports say the bananas that he sold came from the Bahamas. However, they don't know exactly what variety it was. Most bananas sold today are descended from the Cavendish banana, which wasn't the case back then. When he brought the bananas to a shop, he also had a woodcut of the bananas displayed, so you can see that if you're curious in the articles linked on the show notes. So bananas quickly gained popularity among Londoners, although initially they were enjoyed primarily by the wealthy due to their high cost and limited availability. Over time, however, as transportation and trade routes improved, bananas became more accessible to the general population, eventually, like I said, becoming a staple fruit in British households. As for Thomas Johnson, to scientists, he is actually known as, quote, the father of British field botany, end quote. Born in 1600, he established his scientific credentials with his herbal tome, which ran 2,000 pages and had 2,900 illustrations listing plants, where they grew, and their medicinal properties. It actually remained the accepted and trusted text in its field for over 200 years.
Hmm.
Records show that in 1626, Johnson had established his apothecary business in central London, and it was there, of course, on April 10th, 1633, that he put on sale what became known as bananas. According to David Lewis of the Yorkshire Philosophical Society, Johnson was not only an enterprising merchant, but a man possessed with lyrical prose. So here is his description of the banana. Each of the fruits was not ripe, being green, each of them the bigness of a large bean, some 5 inches long and an inch and a half in breadth. The stalk is short and like one's little finger. They hang with their heads down, but if you turn them up, they look like a boat. The husk is easily removed. The pulp is white, soft and tender, and ate somewhat like a muskmelon, end quote. He mentioned that it was green when it arrived. Typically, that is how they are shipped nowadays as well, so they do not get overripe. Once they arrive, they are treated with ethylene, their natural ripening agent. Also a note, based on that, if you put a banana in a brown paper bag overnight with an apple or tomato, it will actually speed up the ripening process.
Hmm, fun fact, I was not aware of that. I'm also wondering, what prompted Johnson to take an interest in selling bananas at his apothecary in the first place? Like, why does he go, you know what? I'm going to try hawking this fruit that very few people have access to and just see how it goes.
He's a botanist. He likes plants. So maybe he had one. It's like, this is great. I want to share it with the public.
Yeah, it's a fair point. You do wonder if he was touting the medicinal properties like you talked about with everything else that he had put in his book with bananas as well. Certainly we know today very high in potassium, great for a lot of things because of that. So, but interesting, certainly I never stopped to really think about when some of these fruits that aren't readily available in our home countries are ultimately shipped elsewhere and sold. And quite frankly, the 1600s feels pretty early for a country like London to be bringing in importing bananas already. So pretty wild.
Yeah, I could see a few bananas, but to actually become popular shortly after that in the 1600s, that does seem surprising. And also, why is he eating it like a muskmelon? That seems kind of odd. That sounds like he's like just ripping off a piece of it and then just going to town on it instead of like peeling the banana entirely. Because I don't know about you, but I don't peel a muskmelon and then hold it and eat it. Like I do a banana. Is he an ape? Is it just peeling this and then just going to town on it?
Really latched onto this eating process here.
It seems odd to me. It seems odd.
Yeah, I don't know. I at that point in time, I doubt anybody really knew what the quote unquote right way to eat a banana was. So I'm going to give him a pass at that point.
Although we still question nowadays the best way to peel a banana. Do you peel it from one end or the other? Some people cut it and then peel it. I don't know. There's a lot of ways to, I guess, peel a banana even nowadays. That'll do it for another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. Connect with us on email at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Also, like us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. He's Marcus Paff. I'm Reggie Rizzo. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.